Okay, well, first of all, thank you very much for the invitation. It's nice to come to a workshop in which there are different topics, because sometimes you get used to hear always the same people. I think it helps to open the mind. So also, please don't hesitate to ask me any question during the talk. And yeah, I'm going to talk about swamp plant related things, in particular implications that can have for particle physics, which is something that I started with Luis Ibáñez and Victor Martín Lozano 2 years ago. So I guess the first question is, what does swamp plant mean? Well, probably all of you know what it means in English, right? It's a not nice place in general. And probably also most of you have already heard about the word swamp plant in physics in terms of several controversial statements that have appeared. And probably very few of you really know how solid they are, like where they are coming from, what we know about them, no? And what are the implications. So I want to start very basic, okay? To try to explain first, like, what is the idea behind the swamp plant, and then what is the state of the art, okay? So the idea is that, I mean, imagine all possible effective field theories that you could construct, adding, I don't know, like the standard model, beyond standard model physics, cosmology, different possible models that could describe different universes. The idea is that not every effective field theory that you construct can be consistent if we want to embed that theory in a consistent theory of quantum gravity in the UV. Okay, so not everything will be consistent with gravity at the end. And the models that are consistent are said to belong to a landscape, while the models that cannot be embedded in a UV completion with gravity belong to the swamp plant. So this is a very old idea, but the name comes from Kun Rombafa and Hiroshi Oguri many years ago. And I think the message that is underlined is that not everything is possible. Right? You cannot just construct whatever you want and try to embed it in the future in a string theory or another theory of quantum gravity. So the definition of swamp plant would be those apparently consistent effective field theories that cannot be UV embedded in quantum gravity. There are different constraints that have been proposed. Some of these constraints have some motivation, which is not necessarily coming from string theory, like black hole physics and many other things, but it's not really clear whether these constraints are like string constraints or are more general than that. I think it's a very interesting question, but since we don't have a real, I don't know, we cannot show that it's more general than string theory, I usually like to talk about the string swamp plant. And we'll see in the future like how general, no? This can be generalized to other theories.
Can I just ask a question?
Yeah.
So the language people use is that they cannot be UV embedded, for
yes.
example. It seems to me that language is strictly perturbative. I mean, we absolutely know nothing about the UV behavior of gravity, non-perturbative. So
that's why I put the adjective of string theory, because then we already know.
It's strictly perturbative.
No, for example, EDSCFT is a non-perturbative formulation of string theory. Wow. So there are some backgrounds in which we have control about non-perturbative physics. It's not so, it's string ADS, perturbative.
Well, obviously ADS has nothing to do with the real universe. So to some extent, we're not physically interested in that.
No, I mean, that's why it depends on the, for example, if any of these conjectures has been proven using Worksheet arguments from string theory, then it's a string perturbative string theory. That's true.
Yeah.
Some of these conjectures, I mean, some of the evidence comes from ADS-CFT, which is non-perturbative. Then I agree that it's more related to ADS, not to DS. No, that's, I guess, your point. I think why, I don't know, these conjectures are receiving so much attention is because the same conjecture is receiving evidence from different perspectives and point of views that maybe they shouldn't be related. Mm. And none of them is complete.
No.
That's for sure. Otherwise, it's not a conjecture.
Right.
But I think what makes us to continue working on that is that we have different, like, also areas of research, different communities that are putting more and more evidence. So there might be something there. Mm. And there might be some more underlying understanding
that we don't
have yet.
My only reason for saying that is that the swamp plant idea is casting doubt on something, right? It's saying it doesn't have a UV completion. And it's ascribing some greater validity to other theories, which it claims do have a UV completion. But all I'm saying is that really we know nothing about UV completion of gravitational fields.
That's the problem. Try to understand more about it. It's easier to answer that questions when we have a specific conjecture, and I can tell you exactly what is known and what is not. But okay, this would be like the idea, okay? Now, I mean, sometimes why we say UV embedded is because if we are asking about what are the constraints that an effective field theory in the infrared has to satisfy to be embedded with quantum gravity, probably the first case that comes to your mind are anomalies, right? This is a quantum consistency, is not necessarily related to non-perturbative physics, but it's a quantum consistency that if you have a semi-classical theory, maybe you don't have any problem, but in the moment in which you have a cage field theory that becomes, and you want to be the theory consistent at quantum level, then you have a new constraint. And this constraint is independent of the scale sometimes, so it's a new constraint in infrared, if you want. So just to give an example, for example, we know that if we have a quantum field theory with scalars and fermions, not all these theories will be consistent anymore when we couple the theory to a gauge field theory, because there might be new anomaly constraints that appear, so we reduce the set of consistent theories, right? Typical example, I have a QFT with one fermion and an SU2 global symmetry, but this theory is completely fine at quantum level, but now I couple a gauge field, and there is a new Witten anomaly that appears and makes the theory inconsistent. So my point of view is that what we are trying to answer here, which is a very ambitious program, is try to understand what happens when we now couple these theories, which are anomaly free, to gravity. What are the constraints that appear? And the interesting part is that there are arguments that make us believe that it's not enough to require the absence of gravitational anomalies to ensure quantum consistency of gravity. So what are the constraints that we need to impose, or how we need to modify our understanding of anomalies, no? When we have gravity. Okay. So the idea is that there might be new additional constraints. And these constraints are UV imprint in the sense that usually quantum gravitational effects are something that are important in the UV, but the point is that this might be misleading, and there may be effects that are non-trivial in the infrared. And that's also interesting for phenomenology, because if that's true, I mean, they could have important phenomenological implications that we are not taking into account yet. So I would say that, let me make some comments about why this is important from the point of view of phenomenology. And the point is that so far, I mean, it has been very useful, our Wilsonian approach in quantum field theory, right? We always consider that we can have some expectation of some separation of scales, in the sense that I can construct some theories in the infrared, and I don't want these models in general to be very sensitive to the UV, okay? I mean, I can, as long as I am within the range of validity of this effective field theory, I can work safely. But I don't know, I think my point of view is that this picture, which has been very useful so far, might fail. And might be some UV-IR mixing that could be induced by these quantum gravity constraints. Okay. And the interesting part is that I think we are already maybe seeing this failing, in the sense that nature is showing us that there might be hierarchy problems, naturalness problems, that maybe this expectation of separation of scales is not the right tool to continue progressing in high energy physics. And for example, if we don't discover new physics in the LHC, maybe this is really telling us that we have to change our approach to the electroweak hierarchy problem. We already have the naturalness problem with the cosmological constant. And the message, and also my motivation, part of my motivation to work on this, is that these quantum gravity constraints, since they are breaking this UV-IR separation of scales, might yield a new approach to understand these naturalness issues. Okay?
Well, I mean, just to be devil's advocate, landscape people would claim that, you just choose the cosmological constant that fits Yes. US, and so they would claim there's no evidence of failure of the Wilsonian approach.
Yeah, but then first I think, I mean, of course, it's always an approach. You can just think of anthropics or
natural. But you want to resist
that. I mean, it's not to resist, it's trying to understand if we are missing something.
Yes.
Right? We need something else. And also, in order to have these landscape arguments, you also need to have a landscape to start with. And it's not so obvious to me that we even have a landscape in which we can just tune the cosmological constant or like it's not just to have one model. We need to have a very dense landscape with a very finely tuned gap.
Do you have a more precise understanding of where the Wilsonian approach might be failing?
I will have some comments at the end of the talk, yes. Yeah. Okay. So I also put a circle there because in this talk, we are going to take one of these conjectures and we are going to show that if the conjecture holds, it's a generalization of the weak gravity conjecture, then we get to the conclusion that the neutrino masses should be of the order of the cosmological constant. So it's not solving all the hierarchy problems, but it's giving a relation between them. So it's just an example of how this intuition of the Wilsonian approach might fail, and there might be new constraints. Okay, so of course, the main question is, what are these constraints? I mean, it's very easy. Very nice to say that there are more constraints, but how you even start finding these constraints, right? So what distinguishes, no, the landscape from the swamp plan? And there are some proposals. Of course, they are not so well understood as the case of anomalies, and that's why they are called conjectures. They are quantum gravity or swamp plan conjectures. And many of them are motivated by string theory. Some of them have arguments that come first from black hole physics. And I have here a summary of the main conjectures. Okay, so I would say like the first ones or the most accepted ones is the absence of global symmetries in the sense that any global symmetry has to be gauged or broken. Okay, you cannot have a global symmetry which is not associated to some local degree of freedom. Related to that is also the completeness hypothesis that every point of the charge lattice has to be populated by a physical state, even if it's supermassive and doesn't appear in your effective theory. But these constraints, they don't really have many implications for low energy physics because they are more constraints about the UV completion, no? Like about the full theory. And why in the last year there has been a lot of activity on the Swan Plan program is because we have started to realize that coming from these older conjectures, there are some refinements that they don't talk about exact global symmetries, but about approximate global symmetries. They try to quantify how much you have to break this global symmetry, how close you can be to the situation of recovering a global symmetry. And that's why... Yeah.
Global symmetry means continuous global symmetry, also discrete.
Yeah, so originally it was continuous, but there are some new papers in which they also generalize it to discrete symmetries.
This is strictly based on string theory, right?
This is based on string theory, ADCFT, and it has hand-waving arguments in terms of black hole physics and evaporation, but those are more hand-waving. Yeah. So for example, in ADCFT it's proven by a locality of the CFT, also for discrete ones. But, okay. So that's why, I mean, since it's about approximate global symmetry, then you can have implications from the infrared because it can tell you how much you have to break the symmetry, okay? So the most important ones are the weak gravity conjecture that maybe you have heard of, and I will describe in more detail in a moment. That is the Swan Plan distance conjecture that I will not discussing this talk, but I have also worked a lot on this, which is about what happens when you try to recover a global symmetry limit and how you have to have infinite tower of states that are becoming light. And these two conjectures became very important because they can put constraints on large field inflation. So in, they have cosmological implications that they seem to disfavor to have large displacements of an scalar. But so there's a lot of activity in this area. They are also the new, more controversial conjectures about the absence of the sitter. I want to, I also put there this line, because there are also, I mean, this is a big field now, and there are different levels of evidence depending on what is the conjecture you are talking about. And many, maybe some of them will be ruled out in the future, and new ones will appear. So it's not a, I mean, they are not theorems, but it's true that, I mean, the upper you go, the more evidence we have for it, and the lower you go, the less evidence, but also sometimes more interesting. So that's the trait. So in this talk, I'm going to focus on this right corner, okay? And I'm going to focus on how from the weak gravity conjecture, also Kumrun and Hiroshi, made an observation that if the weak gravity conjecture holds, it might, this also implies that any ADS vacuum, which is not supersymmetric, should be metastable at best. Okay, you need to have some instability. So I will explain how this goes, and also then how taking this second statement, even if they are for ADS, we can in fact get constraints for our standard model of particle physics and the cosmological constant. Okay? Okay. So the weak gravity conjecture. Okay, so the weak gravity conjecture basically says that you need to have some state in which gravity acts weaker than the gauge force. So you need to have some state which is super extremal, in the sense that the charge is bigger than the mass. And this can be very, made very quantitatively, in the sense that this one, so the charge bigger than the mass, really means that the charge to mass ratio of this state is bigger than the charge to mass ratio of a extremal black hole in that theory. Okay. Now, this came. Let me also say that there is this refinement, which is what will give rise to the relation to the instability in ADS. So this is important. That they claim that the exact equality can only be satisfied if you have supersymmetry, like if you have some way to protect this charge to mass ratio from high order corrections that would deviate the value from one, as usually happens with black holes.
What units?
This is in Planck units. Okay. So this is, and this charge is not the quantized charge. It's the quantized charge times the gauge coupling. Okay. And the mass is in Planck units. So it's an obstruction to have a very tiny gauge coupling. Okay, in the moment you have a very small gauge coupling, you also need to have a very light particle, let's
say. So you need to say where it's coming from?
So the original motivation comes from avoiding, from allowing black holes to decay, extremal black holes to decay, so they have some hand-waving arguments, in the sense that you would have trouble with remnants as well. But since then, there have been many people working on it, and now we have evidence coming from different corners. So the main, one of the main evidence.
For physical arguments, what would go wrong with that?
Yeah, so motivation, there are two main motivations. One is, that black hole, extremal black holes, wouldn't be able to decay, they would be stable, because there is no, once you get to the extremal value, it cannot continue evaporating because you would generate some singularity, some next singularity. So you need to have some particle with a charge to mass ratio bigger than the extremal value so that it can lose the charge and you can evaporate, the black hole can decay. And the argument is that otherwise you would end up with an infinite number of remnants that would get into problem with entropy bounds and so on. So that's one of the motivations, not to have, it's like the same motivation that you have for global symmetries.
Is there an evaluation of how long it takes to get there, or like the time scale?
No, it's not. This is just the requirement that this is like a kinematic requirement. suggests that this decay mode is possible. It's not about how fast or slow it is. It's just about having the possibility of decay. So it's not, I mean, it's just a kinematic requirement.
So I understand it's inconvenient, but you say initially that this would prevent some adding a completion of gravity. So why?
Well, it goes against entropy. It's not related. Okay, this motivation of the black holes is not related to what UV completion you have of the theory. It's just related to the hand waving argument that you would get into trouble with entropy bounds in the sense that you would have infinitely many black holes that are degenerating mass, but with different charge. So you would have like a peak at this value of this value of the mass for the entropy. And this you would get into trouble for any UMRU experiment or anything like that. Like the entropy cannot diverge.
Should just add there was a talk at the conference here last week by Brando Bellizzini claiming to prove this from effective field theory by basically showing that, you know, if you add the leading higher order operators beyond GR that correct the and look for look for spherically symmetric black holes that are extremal once you include those next higher order operators.
This enters into this. So this is the original motivation. Let me say, like the one I was describing is one of the original motivations. Since then, there are many words. This is one of them, which would enter into this category, that the weak gravity conjecture has been proved to be true in certain cases. For example, if you compute higher derivative corrections to black hole, the charge to mass ratio of the black hole, as long as these higher derivative corrections come from integrating out states in a UV complete theory, which is unitary, and you have to preserve causality and so on and so forth, then you get that charge to mass ratio has to be bigger than one, for example. It has also been proven in terms of the stream perturbative theory, in the sense that it relates to modular invariance of the worksheet or of the two-dimensional CFT, if you have a CFT. It has been also related to cosmic censorship, that you preserve cosmic censorship if this bound is preserved, entanglement entropy, like more examples in string theory. So like there are different corners that have appeared in the last few years. And also Arkani Hamed has an ongoing paper in which he's going to show that doesn't matter what UV completion you have, like how many particles, or you will always have this charge to mass ratio bigger than one, unless you have supersymmetry. So, like, there are different papers going on. The original motivation was the black hole decay, and the fact that you cannot recover a global symmetry, because if I send this charge, no, this gauge coupling to zero, I would recover a global symmetry, and if we take as an assumption that global symmetries are not allowed, something has to happen. I mean, some new physics has to occur such that this effective theory breaks down. So it's like a refinement of that. Okay? But I mean, I can discuss any of these papers in more detail if you are interested in any of them in particular later on in the break. Right now, what I would like is to take it for granted, this conjecture, and see what are the implications for the standard model. Okay? But yeah, all these works are very interesting, how everything has been developed. Okay, so the point is that if this weak gravity conjecture is true, it means that every time you have some gauge field theory, you will need to have some state, which is charged, electrically charged under it. And this doesn't necessarily apply only to gauge fields, one-form gauge fields and particles, but it can apply to any p-form gauge symmetry that you have. So what I mean with that is also that if, for example, we think that our four-dimensional world comes from some string theory compactification or some higher dimensional model in which we have extra dimensions, and in these extra dimensions we have gauge fields, if we apply this weak gravity conjecture to the gauge fields in the extra dimensions, what we get is that we need to have some electrically charged states, which in this case they correspond to brains, like extended objects, whose tension, no, like the mass, has to be smaller than the charge. So as long as I have gauge fields in the extra dimensions, from the point of view of four dimensions, these gauge fields will correspond to fluxes and the domain walls, okay, that interpolate different vacua with different value of the fluxes are the states which are charged on the gauge fields and are the states that the weak gravity conjecture tells you you need to have. Okay? So the idea, yeah, this is the idea. Like I have gauge fields in the extra dimension, so I will have some domain wall whose charge to mass ratio is bigger than one. Now, if this is true, this domain wall will always describe an instability of the vacuum, because if the charge is bigger than the tension, it means that the electric repulsion is bigger than the cost of energy of expanding the bubble. So Maldacena proved that this implies that the bubble will expand and it will describe a vacuum decay, okay, from false to true vacuum with a different value of the flux. So what Hiroshi and Kumrun said is that, okay, if we take the weak gravity conjecture and apply to these gauge fields, it means that any vacua which can be understood, no, as coming from higher dimensions and has some flux on some gauge field has to be unstable because of this bubble nucleation. And then they put this conjecture that then non-SUSY vacua are at best metastable. The non-SUSY comes because the SUSY, only if you have supersymmetry, you can ensure that the tension is exactly equal than the charge, and therefore it's just a straight domain wall. It doesn't expand, it doesn't contract. But if you don't have supersymmetry, then it will expand. Okay, any question on this?
Sorry, what do you call it, Arrhenius phobia conjecture?
Ah, yeah, this is the name that Luis Ibáñez put for the conjecture, and he's using it in all the forthcoming papers.
It sounds almost the opposite.
Eh?
It sounds almost the opposite. You're saying that the non-ADS, ADS,
I don't really like the name. I agree with you.
Stick to the non-SUSY.
Yeah, I wanted to emphasize that it's for the non-SUSY one precisely because of this. It's not against ADS. It's against the non-supersymmetric ADS.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the important part.
When you say inconsistent with quantum gravity, do you mean quantum gravity as described by string theory or what?
I mean quantum gravity that preserves the weak gravity conjecture. So for me, I would say so far string theory.
If quantum gravity has nothing to do with string theory.
If the weak gravity conjecture is proving to be valid independently of string theory, as many of these arguments that are related to black hole physics and are not related to string theory, then that should also be true. As long as I have, as long as I have some extra dimensions, maybe that's more important. So I need to have some fluxes in four dimensions. I need to have some gauge fields in the extra dimensions that give rise to a flux. And then these brains are charged under this gauge field. So
no extra dimensions and no string theory.
Yeah, then
maybe none of this.
Yeah,
applies.
They put it. So the conjecture they put, of course, they put the conjecture as if it's a general statement. Like, okay, we have seen that this is true in string theory, having extra dimensions and so on. Let's see if it's general. Another step. That's a conjecture, okay? The derivation comes from having extra dimensions and a gauge field in the extra dimensions and applying the weak gravity conjecture there. Okay? Now,
I mean, extra dimensions are dangerous for many, many reasons beyond this. For example,
that
Penrose has argued for a long time that even one.
There are so many models with extra dimensions that might perfectly work, and there is nothing against that. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I just want to make clear like what are the assumptions. So just keep in mind that there are extra dimensions, you have gauge fields in the extra dimensions, and you apply the weak gravity to those gauge fields. Okay? Let me also say that there has been more papers trying to understand if this is general beyond having gauge fields in extra dimensions. There is also something known I didn't put it in the slide, but there's something known as bubbles of nothing. I don't know if you have heard of it, right? So, especially Oguri, he had some papers in which he was trying to show that even in cases especially focused in ADS-CFT, okay? So some ADS-VACUA in which you didn't have some flux, okay? Or some flux instability, he could show that in those cases, what you had was a bubble of nothing, okay? So which was a bubble of nothing. So it was not related to have a flux in the internal dimensions, but just the decay, no? Because you have a cycle that can shrink, and you have a bubble of nothing that expands. So I think it's very interesting to understand whether there is a deeper reason for this that maybe sometimes is reflected in terms of a brain, no, flux brain nucleation, but other times might be reflected not in terms of a bubble of nothing or another instability. It's also interesting that this bubble of nothing appears when you break supersymmetry. So there might be something going on with the fact that any non-supersymmetric vacuum should be unstable. And I also have an ongoing paper in which we are also working on this bubble of nothing to try to show that there are more, well, it's a generalization of the Huygens bubble of nothing beyond having cycles that shrink, but other surfaces. And it seems that every time you break supersymmetry, you might generate this bubble. So that would be, I don't know, but I don't want to talk about it yet. But okay, but okay. So this is the, I mean, this is the conjecture now. If we don't have supersymmetry, we need to have an instability. Implications for our universe. Well, okay, if we don't have supersymmetry, because we don't have exact supersymmetry, it means that our universe has to be metastable. Okay, maybe that's not a big thing because it's already suggested by the running of the Higgs coupling and other arguments. But the interesting part is that if I have the standard model and I compactify the standard model to lower dimensions, I will show you, and it's a work that started with Arkani Hamed, one can see that there are new vacua that appear, new ADS vacua that appear, which seem to be stable. And then you can say, well, what's the problem with that? It's a compactification of the standard model. So we don't live in lower dimensions, we live in four dimensions, 3+1. But the point is that if we assume background independence, as usually do in string theory, so if we assume that if we have a theory that is consistent, any compactification of the theory, if we do it right, should also be consistent, then we should not get stable, non-supersymmetric ADS vacua from compactifying the standard model, because that would imply that the standard model itself would also be inconsistent. Okay? That's the idea that motivates did our work. So what we do is to require, to impose, the absence of any non-supersymmetric stable ADS vacua that appears in lower dimensions from compactifying the standard model. And by doing that, we get constraints on neutrino masses, the cosmological constant, and so on. Okay? It's clear the idea? Now, there is one assumption here that I want to remark, which is that I'm assuming that even if I have some instability in four dimensions, it's not transferred to three dimensions. Now, whether this happens or not, it depends on the stability itself. It depends on the radius of the bubble. Okay? If the radius of the bubble is larger than the ADS length scale of the lower dimensional vacuum, it will not be an instability. So it's not so yeah, it's a model dependency. Okay? So the idea is that all the constraints that I will show you are not necessary in the sense that maybe there is some instability that we don't know and is transferred to three dimensions and that would make the work. But they are sufficient in the sense that if you have the constraints that I will show you, you don't need to worry about the UV completion or the model dependent issues related to the radius of these bubbles and so on. Okay, so not every, the point is that not every instability in four dimensions will be transferred, it depends on the model. So it's not sufficient in general, and might be that it's not enough. So let's see what else we can do to ensure that this doesn't happen, okay? Yeah? Okay. Good.
Okay, sorry, sure. Quick question. You've got the word non-Suzy in there.
Yes.
But you're starting from the standard model. So
yeah, but it's not supersymmetry.
Yeah.
I mean, it has to be exact supersymmetry. So, I mean, when I say non-SUSY, I don't mind if it has some supersymmetry at high energies. As long as it's broken, then I have this problem, even if it's dynamically broken. Okay. So for our standard model, yeah, it doesn't work. So supersymmetry for us is not enough to protect our vacuum. See? So we need something else. Okay. So why we get constraints? So, okay. The point is that if we have the standard model, so I will start with the standard model plus gravity, okay, and compactify on a circle, okay, Einstein gravity, nothing else. And the point is that if I compactify on a circle, I will have a new scalar field, okay, which is associated to the radius of this circle, okay, which is denoted by R, capital R. And this new scalar field will fill a potential, okay, three dimensions, and I can plot this potential and see if I have any minimum and where the minimum is, right? Like what is the vacuum energy in three dimensions. And the point is that, well, if I have a cosmological constant in four dimensions, this will generate a three-level contribution for this scalar, okay, which is this one. But also I can have quantum corrections coming from the Casimir energy of the standard model particles. And the point is that since in our universe, the cosmological constant is so small, the quantum corrections are in fact important, are of the same order, and you also have to take them into account. Okay? So this Casimir energy, these one-loop corrections are exponentially suppressed if the mass of the particle is very heavy, okay? So if the mass is bigger than 1 over the radius, but become important for light particles. Okay? So what matters here is not the UV completion, I mean, what are the heavy states, but what is the light spectrum of the standard model. Okay? So depending on the light mass spectra and the value of the cosmological constant, the minimum of this potential could be in ADS, in Minkowski, or in the sitter. So if I only have the cosmological constant, I have a positive contribution. If I add, well, the first important contribution comes from the massless particles, okay? Since they are bosons, they will give rise to a negative contribution. And now I have to start adding the massive particles. So I start with the neutrinos because they are the lightest ones. And since they are fermions, they give rise to a positive Casimir energy contribution. So one can show that if the neutrinos are Majorana, because here for the Casimir energy, what matters is just the mass and the number of degrees of freedom. Okay? So if I have Majorana neutrinos, okay, in the sense that I only have a Majorana mass, I don't have enough fermionic degrees of freedom to win over the bosonic ones. So what happens is that I always generate a minimum in ADS. Okay, even if the mass of the neutrino is zero, so it's very important, then I always generate a minimum with negative cosmological constant, which at this level seems stable. Okay? For the case of Dirac, I have more degrees of freedom, so it depends on the exact value of the mass. The minimum can be in ADS, Minkowski, or DS. Okay, can be negative or positive, the vacuum energy. So if one now takes the conjecture that any vacuum should be metastable, should have some decay, then Majorana neutrinos will be ruled out.
Okay? So in particular, the standard model with no right-handed neutrinos.
And if the right-handed neutrinos are very heavy as well, because here I need light degrees of freedom to avoid this minimum. So it's about the light spectra. Okay? The more massive the neutrinos, also the deeper is the ADS vacuum. Okay? And the more difficult is to get rid of it, of the vacuum. So the conclusion, if one takes the conjecture to hold, is that Majorana neutrinos are blocked, and there is an upper bound on the mass of the Dirac neutrino, if they are Dirac. So it cannot be too massive, because then the contribution is not big enough, it's not important enough to win over the bosonic ones that they have because they are massless. And then in particular, the bound is that if you have normal hierarchy or inverse hierarchy for neutrinos, you get that it's of the order of 7 or 2 mV.
Sorry, is that the lightest neutrino?
Yeah, this is for the lightest one, yes.
What is the bound on the other?
The other, for in this computation, we take the mass splitting that is known. Oh, and then it's only the lightest neutrino is a free parameter.
I see.
Or I guess.
But in principle, it should be a bound on.
It's in fact, what we get is a bound on the three of them, like the mass, yeah. The sum of the masses.
Right.
And
is that allowed phenomenologically?
Well, you can just take this value and then sum the mass gap that we know, and that's the bound that we really get, like the sum of
so
the three.
It's still allowed. So,
yeah.
I guess usually when we have if the three light neutrinos are Majorana, we're assuming that three heavy guys are much heavier than that bound, but I guess if they're down below that bound, they could just all six be Majorana.
Yeah,
down.
Exactly. I will show some plots. So if we assume that they are new, very light fermionic degrees of freedom, like right-handed neutrinos or even other dark sector, then we can help also to avoid the.
But there's no complication with the seesaw, for example. Because
for the seesaw, I mean, you need. The point.
No, only if the right-handed ones are stable. They're unstable, they wouldn't contribute. At least your calculation wouldn't be valid.
The problem is that with the seesaw mechanism, usually we have the right-handed neutrinos very heavy.
Right.
So the contribution, the Casimir energy is exponentially suppressed and doesn't change anything. Like, you need to have light fermionic degrees of freedom to avoid this vacua.
Okay.
And light means of the order of the milli-electron volt. Okay? So actually, this number, okay? I mean, this is a number because I already put the value of our cosmological constant, okay? So one can also do the same computation, but leaving the cosmological constant as a free parameter. And then what we have is a relation between the value of the cosmological constant and the neutrino mass, okay? So the green area is the allowed area in the sense that there are no stable vacua. And the red area is forbidden by this conjecture. So what we get is an upper bound on the neutrino mass in terms of the cosmological constant, or the opposite, a lower bound of the cosmological constant in terms of the neutrino mass. Okay? And this bound, like this relation, I mean, to saturate the bound, is precisely at the order of the milli-electron volt. Okay? So the cosmological constant has to be of the order of the neutrino mass. And the neutrino mass cannot be heavier than that, because otherwise you would always generate this vacuum. So it sort of explains or provides an explanation for this numerical coincidence that we observe in our universe. Okay? Okay. So now this upper bound on the neutrino mass can also be translated to an upper bound on the electroweak scale, because, I mean, if we assume that the neutrino mass comes from the Higgs vacuum expectation value. So we can just translate it to a bound on the Higgs VEF. And what this is saying is that if you impose that our standard model of particle physics satisfies this conjecture, then you have an upper bound on the electroweak scale in terms of the value of the cosmological constant. So if we happen to live in a universe in which the cosmological constant is small, then the electroweak scale also has to be small. And how small is precisely that if the cosmological constant is of order the milli electron volt to the fourth, then the electroweak scale has to be of the order, of the TV, less than the TV. So it's just there are the assumptions that I have talked to you. So this is not, I'm not claiming that I'm solving the electroweak hierarchy problem, because I have to show first that the conjecture holds. But it's an example of how these conjectures can have implications for the hierarchy problems that we observe in our universe. Because in this case, even if from the point of view of the infrared, there is no reason to think of this connection at all, and there is no problem with having a larger electroweak scale, what this is saying is that there is some part of the, I mean, there are some parameters, some part of this parameter space, which is not allowed. So the all these fine-tuning problems that we are describing are not really there because there is a part which I cannot access. So maybe it just takes the highest value that can take, but maybe this highest value is just the TV scale. Okay? So I reduce the space of parameters, which is allowed by quantum gravity. Okay, I also have some comments in the sense that here what matters is the light spectra, as I was saying, but of course, yeah, it will also change if I have new beyond standard model particles, which are very light. For example, if I add fermions, new fermions, right-handed neutrinos, which are very, very light, like usually sterile neutrinos, or other dark sector coming from a dark sector, I can help to avoid these bounds. So one can also interpret that the detection of Majorana neutrinos would be consistent with this bound only if there is also new physics in the sense of new light fermionic degrees of freedom coming with it, okay, coming together. So you can just play with the different bounds and see how heavy has to be the new fermion so that the Majorana neutrinos are allowed, and it's usually of order, well, yeah, smaller than 2 mV. Okay? If I add bosons, it's the opposite. It gets more difficult to get rid of the vacuum. So for example, if I only have one more light boson coming, for example, from QCD, like the QCD axion, then also Dirac neutrinos would be ruled out. So you cannot just have the QCD axion in that sense. You need to have more fermions or other degrees of freedom. Now, if I have many axions, what happens is that the negative contribution from the boson is too big, that in fact what I generate is not a minimum, but a runaway. So then it would also be allowed again. So the problem comes only when you have small number of light bosons, but not many of them, so that you can generate the runaway. Okay? Yes, an example of what can happen if you start playing with these bounds. And yeah, yes, I talk about the circle, but you can also do the same game, compactifying to in a torus, to lower dimensions. You get the similar bounds, it just changes a bit the quantitative value, but it's not very important. And you can also study orbifold compactification in which you have additional discrete symmetries. And then here there is something interesting that happens, that it seems that you need these bounds and the neutrino masses that I showed you, but that's not enough. If you have these orbifolds, then you also need to have more bosons in the UV. So you need to have some completion of the standard model. And the fermionic degrees of freedom are not enough. So you need to have, for example, supersymmetry, but there could be also other completions in the sense that you need to have more bosonic degrees of freedom that are not too light, but will be there at some point to avoid the minima. There is a new minima that appears when you go to higher energies. Okay.
Are there calculations of the rate?
It's not so easy because it depends exactly on the spectra. There is a computation if you put, okay, I have these bosons, and this is the mass splitting between them. And then you say, okay, the lightest one has to be there. But in general, completely general, no. So if we take, for example, the MSSM, that there are many things that are constrained, then in this paper you can see some concrete bounds. And it's usually at the level of the multi-TV range that appear. High multi-TV range.
Are you close to being done? Or
I finished. So we are already late. So this is just, I just have this last slide. It was just a comment in the sense that I have shown you one way in which quantum gravity can constrain the space of parameters and give rise to new correlations in the infrared. There is also another way to understand how all these quantum gravity conjectures can change our Wilsonian approach. And it's more related to the fact that these conjectures the last years we are understanding these conjectures as quantum gravity obstruction to recover global symmetries, and how, in fact, they imply not only one new particle, but a tower of particles or many particles. And this, in fact, changes the running of the couplings and everything. So for example, for the Higgs coupling, to have one light particle implies a logarithmic running, but if you have an infinite tower, it becomes polynomial. So there's a qualitative difference, and this can also change all these fine-tuning arguments and these, well, these naturalness issues. But I can talk about it in the break if you want. And just since I think we all want to go for lunch, let me just stop with the summary and open for questions. So thank you very much.